Hi, it's Mountain Edition, all the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley and from around the state, coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Zoe Rome, and I'm here with Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
Hi, Zoe.
Hi, Elizabeth. Snowmakers are hard at work on Aspen Mountain in anticipation of this weekend's opening. Skiers can enjoy Aspen Mountain a few days early this year thanks to strong early season snow and cold temperatures.
Eagle County's open space program is eyeing projects in the Roaring Fork Valley, but won't say exactly where.
And Colorado's hate crime rates aren't going down.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
Aspen Skiing Company expects top-to-bottom skiing when Aspen Mountain opens Saturday.
The combination of above-average early-season snowfall and cold temperatures mean an early start to this ski season. SkiCo says the Gondola, Ajax Express, Little Nell, and Bell Chairs will be running. Skiers can expect intermediate runs like One and Two Leaf and Spar Gulch, as well as flash openings of more advanced terrain. SkiCo spokesman Jeff Hanley says a storm Sunday night that brought up to 10 inches to the top of area mountains was key in deciding to open the mountain top to bottom.
The storm really was great. I mean, it couldn't have come out better. It was more productive than we thought it would be, and the cold temperatures are just a bonus.
Those cold temperatures contribute to more efficient snowmaking. Hanley says snowmaking operations on Aspen Mountain are more than a third of the way complete for this ski season.
A Basalt resident will serve on the Governor's Active and Healthy Lifestyle Council. Governor John Hickenlooper appointed Basalt resident Amanda Wagner to serve on the Council for Active and Healthy Lifestyles. Wagner is the CEO and president of the Aspen Clinic, a fitness center in the Mid-Valley.
Wagner says this is an opportunity to spotlight the sometimes invisible health challenges facing the valley.
We have this unique perception that everyone's healthy because our body fat percentages are lower than the rest of the country. But in reality, a lot of our issues are mental health issues.
Her work will also focus on drawing attention to the ways health and fitness can enhance the Western Slope economy. She will serve for 4 years on the council. Eagle County voters extended a property tax to fund the county's open space program. The tax now sunsets in 2040. Aspen Public Radio's Wyatt Warm reports on what Roaring Fork Valley residents can expect to see from the tax.
Diane Moriello is the Eagle County Open Space Manager. She's keeping tabs on different properties in the Roaring Fork Valley, but won't say which ones.
We are always eyeing different things, and we tend to not disclose what those are. We tend to look at properties quietly.
She says big land acquisitions can take years to put together. The Eagle County Open Space Program, she says, often collaborates with Pitkin County and the Aspen Valley Land Trust. Take the Glacier Open Space near Basalt. Eagle County contributed $2.5 million toward that purchase. Currently, the tax generates around $4.5 million each year. Wyatt Orme, Aspen Public Radio News.
Aspen Community Theater's run of Big River is back on stage this weekend. The musical is a 1985 adaptation of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, set in the South during the time of slavery. Aspen Community Theater's production eliminates much of the racist language in the original. However, staging older theater productions often raises questions about portrayals of race, gender, and American history that go deeper than words. Kristen Kay reports.
Times in a time of trouble.
Local actor Gerald DeLisser's favorite song in Big River is River in the Rain. During this number, DeLisser's character, Jim, a runaway slave, solidifies his bond with Huck Finn, a young white boy, while they huddle on a raft on the Mississippi.
When he offers his blanket that he's using to shelter himself from the rain, for me to use it as well, I feel like that's the moment where we really connect as equals and really true friends.
The friendship between a white and a black character and the anti-slavery message in The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn were shocking to many white readers in 1885. By the time Big River was written in 1985, it was the racist language in the book that took audiences aback. Producer Rita Hunter did some research before Aspen Community Theater took on Big River.
I read Mark Twain again just to make sure. I read the story and thought, because there's a lot more language that can be offensive for sure, or is offensive.
Aspen Community Theater chose an adapted script for this production. It substitutes words like servant or slave for racial slurs. Director Marissa Post says that when the N-word is used, it's meant to highlight a character's racism, not condone it.
We, I believe, are using it maybe six times in the entire piece, and the characters that use it are the actual people that would sell someone else.
Actor Gerald DeLisser says that eliminating all racist language would paint an inaccurate picture of the time in which the play is set.
I'm not really for the whitewashing of history.
However, questions have been raised about Big River and many works seen as classics that go beyond just the use of the N-word. After a 2017 revival in New York, a New York Times theater critic said the production felt ill-timed in an era of reevaluating film and theater roles for African Americans. She said the slave character Jim is sidelined while the story focuses on the experiences of white males. DeLisser says that Jim's portrayal in Big River isn't as overtly racist as in Twain's novel, but it's still a bit problematic.
I mean, not that he's smart in this production, but in the Mark Twain book, he's even more of a kind of like a caricature, almost like a minstrel, almost black person.
Bud Coleman teaches American theater history at the University of Colorado. He says that older works can challenge theater companies to reevaluate casting choices and reflect history more accurately. Take the 1943 musical, Oklahoma.
You know, it's really kind of creaky in terms, especially of its sexual politics. And there's no mention of Native Americans in the entire piece, yet it takes place in Native American land.
Coleman says that even when sticking to an outdated script, production choices can kickstart critical thinking. He says modern revivals of Oklahoma have included an all-black cast to highlight the existence of black townships on the western frontier, and the casting of transgender actors or females in male roles to challenge the audience to think about gender in different ways. Theater companies can also take steps outside of the production itself to raise awareness about the context in which a play was written and why they're staging it.
They can start talks before the production even opens to help set the cultural context that they hope to generate a conversation. And then there could be a follow-up discussion.
Aspen Community Theater isn't hosting discussions about Big River, but producer Rita Hunter says the message about friendship could not be more clear.
I can't imagine, but I could be just living in the clouds, anyone not getting the gist of the story and interpreting it in any other way.
Director Marissa Post does want audiences to think about the messages in the musical.
It is the quintessential anti-racism story, and it is as applicable today as it was back in the day when it was written.
Gerald DeLisser agrees.
A white boy and a black man, and you just never see two people like that hanging out and being friends and sharing such a great experience together.
An experience that Aspen audiences have the opportunity to reflect on as the show continues its run this weekend. Kristen Kay, Edlis Neeson, Arts and Culture Desk.
The Arts and Culture Desk at Aspen Public Radio is funded by the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation with a mission to support the arts, community, and outreach.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
And I'm Zoe Rome. Elizabeth, dedicated Aspen Public Radio listeners are engaged with what's going on in their communities. And that's why they tune in to all of our programming, including Mountain Edition, where we take them back over what happened this past week.
That's right. Mountain Edition is one of many ways listeners can stay up to date. We also have a Twitter account. Our handle is Aspen Pub Radio. And you can like our Facebook page.
On our Facebook page, you can interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly.
You can get your local news throughout the day online at aspenpublicradio.org. Go deeper into the stories you hear on air with slideshows, extended interviews, and breaking news updates. You can also stream or podcast your favorite local public affairs shows. See what's new at aspenpublicradio.org.
Senator Kerry Donovan from District 5 was appointed whip of the Democratic caucus last week. The whip acts as an ambassador for bills, working to make sure legislation is well written and it has the support it needs to pass. They work with other legislators and, in Donovan's case, the Democratic majority leader to usher bills through the legislature.
Explain the bill and make sure people understand the need to support these bigger idea bills.
Donovan says it's an exciting opportunity to highlight her home district in the State House. The first regular session of the 72nd General Assembly starts January 4th of next year.
The number of hate crimes committed in Colorado held relatively steady last year. As Scott Franz reports, groups working to prevent these crimes remain concerned.
Police responded to 106 hate crimes around the state last year. More than half of them were racially motivated. The number was flat compared to 2016, but some residents are concerned because the state hasn't seen the number of hate crimes drop over the last 3 years. The Colorado Anti-Defamation League's Jeremy Shaver says hateful messages continue to spread.
We've seen, you know, banners with a white supremacist message being hung over I-25 near Colorado Springs, a group gathering in Civic Center Park in Denver just this last weekend holding a banner that had an anti-immigrant message.
Nationally, hate crimes were up 17% last year. A big portion of them was attributed to a rise in anti-Semitic attacks. I'm Scott Franz.
As governments across the world work to address climate change, big businesses are doing the same. David Hone is the chief climate change advisor to the energy company Shell. He was in Aspen this week discussing the company's plan to limit global temperature rise. Elizabeth talked with Hone about the sky scenario, Shell's outline for energy transition.
David Hone believes there's a way to limit the worst impacts of climate change, but it means a high level of global coordination. It starts, he says, with charging a fee for greenhouse gas emissions.
Carbon pricing is one of the key policy levers that is available. And, the ideal construction would be that you had some sort of globally uniform approach.
A carbon fee is central to Shell's Sky Scenario, an outline that aims to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement. The plan sketches actions like a carbon price and a move to electric power across the energy sector and into some areas less familiar to an oil company.
But the company is also looking at how an industry such as ours can get more involved in reforestation.
Hone says a holistic approach that includes changes to land use practices and agriculture can be particularly important. He explains while it's relatively simple to replace coal and gas with solar and wind,
you can't easily reduce emissions in the aviation sector. So you have to look at some other way potentially of negating those emissions, and nature-based solutions are one way forward.
Hone says Shell and other fossil fuel companies have supplied the energy of the modern world. But now it's time to find solutions to the issues associated with this energy. And he's hopeful, to an extent.
The technologies are there today. The policies are well understood. It's just a question of political and societal will to implement them on a cooperative basis.
That was David Hone, chief climate change advisor for Shell.
Krista Sadler is a paleontologist, geologist, and former river guide on the Colorado River. Her new book, The Colorado, explores the intimate connections that humans have with the ancient waterway. Zoe spoke with Sadler about her relationship to the river and what other explorers, like John Wesley Powell, learned from their time on the river.
How has being a paleontologist affected how you experience the river?
I think as a paleontologist and geologist, I have a different sense of time than a lot of people who go down the river. Like, we are one frame in a movie that's been going on for billions of years and will continue on after us for billions of years. And that's not to negate our role in, you know, what we do to this planet and damaging the planet. But it does remind me that, above all, the planet will survive us. And that's kind of comforting at certain times.
Since you've had this relationship with the Colorado River, have you noticed or experienced changes in it?
Most of the changes that I've noticed have been in areas surrounding the river that can affect the river, whether it's uranium mining or development of places near the Grand Canyon or other parts of the Colorado Plateau. I have noticed some changes. There's definitely changes in the way the dams are managed, and that affect the resources downstream. We've noticed a lot of things like beaches getting smaller in the Grand Canyon and the disappearance of native fish. And so there are changes that we can see even over a matter of a few decades. It doesn't take millions of years to have these changes occur to our landscapes.
What is something about John Wesley Powell that people might not know?
He saw where we are right now with water and water issues in the West 150 years ago. He absolutely saw it coming. There was no question, to the point where he even says, you guys are going to have lawsuits and conflict over this. He really could see the land for what it was and what it wasn't.
That was author, scientist, and river guide Krista Sadler. She's discussing her new book, The Colorado, tonight in Carbondale.
The Lift 1 corridor involves a complete rehaul of the base of Aspen Mountain's west side. Developers are planning two new lodges, a museum, the moving of a historic building, and a new ski lift. Allison Bektesh walked the site earlier this week and is here with me now. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Zoe.
So can you start with the big picture here? If the Lift 1 corridor project is approved, what changes will we see on Aspen's west side?
Well, I think actually Community Development Director Jessica Garrow said it best with a memo that she wrote to Aspen City Council. She writes that this project will transform the west side of Aspen Mountain and that neighborhood in fundamental ways. She lists mountain views, traffic, parking, construction noise, the skier experience. She says this all needs to be carefully understood and thoroughly evaluated. So she's saying fundamental changes because it is going to change the character of that side of Aspen and the skiing experience on Aspen Mountain there. We're talking brand new buildings being built. We're talking a brand new lift. And this is all in an area where there's currently a park and no real signpost that's welcoming you to mountain access. The new buildings are lodges, so they're kind of hybrid hotel and private ownership that we see throughout town. They'll have restaurants and patios. Think Shlomo's is part of the residences at Little Nell over by the gondola right now. There's going to be that brand new lift that goes all the way down to what is now Willoughby Park. The skier chalet steakhouse will be moved just a little north on Aspen Street and will serve as a restaurant. And the skier chalet lodge will serve as a ski museum, and that'll be run by the Aspen Historical Society.
So you were at the site where the developers walked through the plans. What did you learn?
So I think the best thing to do is just talk about Aspen Street, because I know this is a part of town where people don't necessarily have the map in their mind, but this is what they're calling the Lift 1 corridor. It's a long, skinny corridor starting at Aspen and Dean Street and going up Aspen Mountain. I've seen these plans quite a bit, but standing there is really different, and I encourage people to go there. They have stakes set up and markers of where the footprint of these different buildings are going to be, and that feel from Dean Street is going to be the biggest difference. When we were there, there were height poles set up, so showing how tall, just one skinny pole going all the way up to where the top of a building would be. And some people pointed out how far down into town the shadows just of those poles were. It was noon on a Monday, and to imagine how much the shadows of the buildings would then go into town. The look itself is more of your typical resort feel. It's a more thought out entrance to a mountain. As a skier looking down, your experience isn't as different as a pedestrian looking up. So the skier coming down will still be able to see Red Mountain. There'll just be more roofs, and then you'll make your way down a skinnier corridor to get back to the lift.
This is a proposed project. How close is it to being reality?
This week, both Lift One Lodge and Gorsuch House, so the two new developments, both of those plans were in front of City Council. And City Council is giving some feedback through multiple meetings. Then they're also accepting public feedback. I will say that these have already been through some reviews by the Aspen Historic Preservation Commission and the Aspen Planning and Zoning Commission, and they're chugging right along. So all these public meetings will continue to happen, but the date that we have our eye on is March 2019. That's when the city of Aspen is hoping to have a ballot measure that goes to voters asking if they can change the zoning that would allow for any of this development to happen anyway.
There was some public comment during the council review earlier this week. What are they saying?
So a lot of people came out in support of this Lift One corridor. Tons of people want to see a faster lift there and are willing to get a lodge or some big buildings in that area as a trade-off for that. People are also proponents of the lodges, of having some sort of food and beverage operations on the return experience there at the bottom of the mountain. We also have people on the other side saying this is too big. It doesn't feel like who we are. There's the west side of Aspen Mountain diehards who like that it's quiet, who like that that lift is slow. And so all of those conversations are continuing to happen. There's also a series of meetings to inform the public more about the project. It is being put on by the developers, so it's going to be pro-development. Those meetings continue this week, tomorrow and Friday. There's multiple meetings at the Gorsuch Ski and Cafe where people can learn more about the project.
Thanks, Allison.
Thanks, Zoe.
You can see site plans online at aspenpublicradio.org.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
And I'm Zoe Rome. Check out our newest show, Airtime. We at Aspen Public Radio spend our days talking to a lot of interesting people. They might live here or just be visiting.
And only a fraction of those conversations make it into the programming you hear every morning. Airtime is a show where we bring you those long, in-depth conversations that might not have a place in the daily news cycle.
Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org or tune in on Wednesdays at 3:30.
The Basalt Police Department is asking for $130,000 to fund a better mental health support system for both officers and community members in crisis. They've applied for a Peace Officer Mental Health Support Grant through the Colorado Department of Local Affairs.
A portion of the grant money would directly assist police officers who are often first on the scene when responding to crisis. Basalt Police Chief Greg Knott says it's a demanding job and officers need support.
Law enforcement officers go to a lot of scenes, and all of those images and the encounters that they have do have an impact on our officers.
Money would be used to provide additional counseling services for police officers who can struggle with mental health issues after responding to traumatic events. They also hope to strengthen their ties with the Aspen Hope Center to assist members of the public who are in crisis.
I believe that we're seeing more calls involving mental health, and this is our way to better serve individuals that are facing mental health crisis.
A portion of the grant would fund the Hope Center crisis hotlines and pay for a dedicated on-call mental health professional. This person would help officers respond to people with mental health disorders in crisis and work with individuals and families after traumatic events.
This is news from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. The new business incubator, CoVenture, wants to be front and center in downtown Carbondale. It's asking the town to write a check to help make that happen. At the Board of Trustees meeting on Tuesday night, CoVenture made its pitch, and the trustees had a lot of questions. To learn more, I'm joined in the studio by Aspen Public Radio's Wyatt Orem. Hi, Wyatt.
Hi, Allison.
What is CoVenture and what do they want to do in Carbondale?
CoVenture wants to start a co-working space in Carbondale. You might be thinking Carbondale already has a co-working space, which is Glen X. CoVenture is Glen X, just rebranded. Glen X will still exist, but Glen X in Carbondale is now CoVenture. Think about it that way. Co-working is a shared work environment. It's just a space. It's an office, basically, where people who work remotely or freelancers or entrepreneurs can go instead of working at home or coffee shop or at the library. And the idea is if you get different kinds of people together in one space, they all have different skills, they have different talents and interests, that's where innovation can start to happen.
And CoVenture is asking the town for $25,000. For what?
To apply for a grant from the state, and they need local partners. Garfield County has committed to supporting CoVenture financially. Lots of different businesses have as well. CoVenture still has some money to raise, and they want Carbondale to help close the gap. And if Carbondale contributes, the folks from CoVenture say their application will be all the more competitive.
And this money combined will help for what?
So the money combined will basically help to create a space in downtown Carbondale. Someone on the board of CoVenture already owns a building downtown and is willing to subsidize rent. Basically, what CoVenture is asking the town is for money in order to set up operations and remodel the space in order to get it to where they want it to be.
Okay, so they're asking for all this money. How did the town respond at the meeting this week?
All the trustees are interested in the idea of a co-working space. They're all interested in economic development. But several made the point that $25,000 is a lot of money. They said there are nonprofits who do great work in the town. They come asking the town for $2,500, and the town can barely afford to get them that. Hmm. And CoVenture is asking for 10 times that amount. That said, giving money to CoVenture is arguably an investment. The town needs to decide on their 2019 budget in December, so they'll need to make a decision on this CoVenture money, at least by that point.
Thank you, Wyatt.
You're welcome.
This is news from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh.
Last year, the Trump administration reduced the size of Bears Ears National Monument by 85%. Now, the federal government is taking public comment on a draft management plan for the monument. Today is the last day for feedback. To learn more about the implications of the proposed change, Elizabeth spoke with former press officer for the White River National Forest, Bill Kite. Kite recently retired from nearly 40 years in land management and has also worked as an archaeologist.
Bill, can you explain your connection to Bears Ears? You've spent a lot of time on that landscape, I understand.
I have off and on over the years visited a lot of places there. I fought fire there and I know the stories that come from there, and I respect the Native people I've worked with and their representatives to tell me if that area needs to be preserved, and I see it with my own eyes. The places that we are drawn to, we're drawn to for a reason, and the freedom of that part of Utah, the sacredness of it, the ability to read the geography and understand that place is special, and that the public deserves to have it protected to the utmost possibility.
Can you describe what is protected in Bears Ears National Monument and why?
Well, what is not protected in the current, what I consider to be illegal, Bears Ears National Monument, which doesn't even protect Bears Ears, are thousands of the sites. The original protection was a compromise between the 1.9 million acres that the tribal groups wanted and the 1.35 million acres that the Obama administration settled for. And so that, to me, is the lowest amount. To reduce it down to 85% of what it was is just criminal, as far as I'm concerned.
As you mentioned, the Antiquities Act gives presidents the authority to protect the, quote, smallest area compatible. And there certainly has been conflict in understanding what that means. Can you speak to, in your experience as a public servant, as somebody who's worked in public land management for a long time, how should we figure out that smallest area compatible?
Well, it was already figured out by President Obama, because he didn't set aside all the acreage that the tribes had recommended. And so as a result, that was a part of compromise. And compromise always gets things done. And so we had a national monument that the Native people who had requested it and had worked for 80 years to try to get Congress to set aside that area, they saw it as a partial victory. And the fact that it was a partial victory meant there are a lot of people worked on that. So much work went into that that I trust, having worked with those people, that the smallest area possible was what was set aside by Obama.
In this most recent part of the process, there has been criticism saying that it's excluded meaningful input from the tribes. What kind of input should the tribes have right now?
It should be treated as any government-to-government relation is authentic would treat them, which is as a sovereign nation in government-to-government relationship. That's not what I saw in the draft documents. They're treating them just like another stakeholder. They're not adhering to the original provision for creating a tribal council of the five tribes representative. It's been narrowed down to only two representatives. And so it's just one thing after another that gets whittled down. To diminish the role of the ancient people who live there by reducing their input in any way from what was promised them through that proclamation is, to me, criminal, just another broken treaty.
I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to this public process that we're in the middle of now, that's about to wrap up on Thursday.
Yes. You know, the public process is often long and drawn out. And under this present administration, it's been compressed and compromised. And I don't feel that there was adequate public representation. It's such a short time frame that they started this whole thing. They want it done in a certain very compressed time frame.
That was Bill Kite, who retired from work with the White River National Forest in 2016. Today is the deadline to comment on the draft management plan.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
And I'm Zoe Rome. AspenPublicRadio.org is your one-stop shop for local, national, and world headlines. All of our on-air news stories are archived online, so you never miss a newscast. You can stream more podcast shows like this one and NPR special reports, browse photo slideshows, and find supplemental links to further coverage. Go deeper, go to AspenPublicRadio.org.
Join us tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup, when host Allison Bechtesh sits down with reporters from around the valley.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.